Hi, my name's Michael Earl, and I'm a female alcoholic. Boy, another crowded room. It's a privilege to be here. I really want to thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me and putting this together. I love doing anything in Alcoholics Anonymous except for speaking. But I get to do it. excuse me. When I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 36 years ago, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. I always swore I was never going to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I managed not to take a drink for 25 years. Thank God I finally took that drink and found out what the real problem was. My mom really wanted to be sober. She did a lot of things to try to be sober. Both of us really wanted sobriety. And we both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort. Different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist, and of course the result was nil. But the good news is today that psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort. Different times in different congregations, but the result was the same. And believe it or not, today, that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to joke around and say, I think we drove these two men to drink. And this is the truth. My mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. But one thing I know is that psychiatrist, that minister, and myself are perfect examples that AA works when other things fail. A little bit about my background. I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate. And being born out of wedlock today is just not a big deal. But when I was a little girl growing up, it was. My childhood is pretty appalling. So my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood. Because as bad as mine was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. I lost my mom about 23 years ago. She died of lung cancer. And I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. My sister and I took my mom home. We had hospice come in. And my mom actually got to die with a little bit of dignity. I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch her drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. Probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. But one thing I learned from this whole experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things that I didn't want to be like, I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets trying to raise herself because her father was in a chain gang. I guess that's some kind of prison. And so 13, she's on the streets trying to raise herself. At the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me, and she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married, had three boys. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepfather moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids. We were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty. Always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even having to sleep in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism. I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with all of her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again. And this time she sent my three younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers are my best friends. When you're always being evicted and you're sleeping in cars, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. The drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me that I had issues of abandonment. I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away, and my three brothers went away, and my mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I've always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first, I learned that feelings are not facts. All those things I used to think about myself are not the truth. But best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. In this last 23 years or 24 years, I walked through two of my biggest fears, and one of them is getting up here at the podium and sharing my story. Never got up at a podium until I was 11 years sober. And the other fear was getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years of sobriety to finally get on an airplane. And I found out I'm not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. And my sponsor told me I'd better be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. Excuse me. I used to hear things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not necessarily in the big book. And so it's somebody's opinion. And we all have opinions. That's part of our experience, strength, and hope. But sometimes they can confuse a newcomer. And the one thing I used to always hear is that you could not have fear and faith at the same time. That if you had fear, you didn't have any faith. And I couldn't figure out what I'd done wrong in my program, because I had worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. I've had spiritual experiences, but I still had all this overwhelming fear. And I went up to this gentleman and I asked him. He used to pass out coins that said fear on one side and faith on the other side. And I asked him, why do I still have all this fear? And he told me in the most arrogant, smug way, he said, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Today I know I had taken a thorough third step. To me, the third step's a promise. I mean a process. And I'm talking about a thorough third step. It's more than just saying a prayer. To me, the process is taking the actions of 4 through 9. When I've taken the actions of 4 through 9, I know I've taken a thorough third step. I finally went up to one of the old-timers that was really instrumental in my sobriety, and a lot of things in my sobriety that were so important. And I was crying on his shoulder. I think I was just trying to tattle on this other old-timer about him saying I hadn't taken a thorough third step. And basically what he told me is, he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it say you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he pointed out a sentence to me on page 68, which is under the fear inventory. And that sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. Then he took me to the bottom of that paragraph, and it gives you that fear prayer. God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm always directed to work with another person, whether they're in the program or out of the program. If I can get out of me, God can take care of this situation. Excuse me. The first time I had to fly for Alcoholics Anonymous, a girl was going to take me to the airport and kind of push me on the plane. And an emergency happened, and she just dropped me off at LAX. And I just knew I couldn't get on that plane. I just knew it. I had a severe panic attack. I fell back in the chair, and I just started to weep. And at that point, I had a spiritual experience. I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was loud and it was clear. And it said, Michael, why don't you just get out of yourself and try and help somebody? It wasn't real kind. It was really like telling me what to do. And I just kind of perked up, and I looked around, and I thought, this isn't an AA meeting. How can I help somebody if this isn't an AA meeting? And then I noticed at the escalator, there were little old ladies struggling with their bags to get their bags up the escalator to where the planes were. So I just jumped up, ran over there, and started helping these ladies with their bags, getting them up the escalator. And I did that for about a half hour, and it worked so well that every time I had to fly, I'd report to the escalator like I worked there. And when I get into any kind of turbulence and you can't jump up and ask to help somebody, I always carry pen and paper with me. And I start to write out the third step prayer and put somebody else in it. And it just gets me through these situations every time. You can see the planes have landed. I'm still here. And I've been getting on a lot of planes for a lot of years. It's still not real comfortable for me. I wish I could say it was, but it's not. But the deal is, I walk through that fear. I don't let that fear paralyze me anymore, because there was a time it paralyzed me. I couldn't get out of the city of Long Beach. I could get to work, a meeting, and home, and that was it. My world was real, real small. Anyway, that last sentence in that paragraph, the fear paragraph, says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. It does not say at once we outgrow fear. It says we commence to outgrow fear. So here I am, 36 years sober, and I'm still commencing. And that's okay, because that's covered in steps 10 and 11. In step 10, it says, we're to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It says it's not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. And then it's reiterated in step 11 on retiring at night. The very first question is, were you selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? It says, do you owe an apology? Have you kept something to yourself you should share with another person? It asks for the good things, because it's a constructive inventory, not bad inventory, you know, not destructive. And so it asks, were you kind and loving toward all? Well, if I'm kind and loving towards 90% of the people, I give myself credit, because I used to take that 10th step and beat myself up with it. It asks if you packed into the mainstream of life. If you're sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, at this moment, you're packing into the mainstream of life. You're not out there doing what we normally do on Saturday nights. And then the very end of that paragraph, it says, we must be careful not to drift in worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that diminishes our usefulness. So once you've done the work, you need to let it go to the best of your ability. You need to let it go. And you don't bring things up out of your inventory or things out of your 10th step again unless it will help another person. And that's what it says later on, and I think it's 132, 133. It says that we almost relive the horrors of our past if it will benefit another alcoholic. But that's the only time I bring it back up. So when I was 13, my mom had this baby, and I learned how to be a mom, and I didn't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never, ever around. And I had full responsibility of this baby. And this baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer. I eventually had to potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. Now, after doing my inventory, I found out the truth was I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. And so specifically to get out of my home life, at the age of 15, I got married. The man I married lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. I have such a colorful past. I like to brag about this. I want everyone here to know when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I truly did. I had these two TV shows. They were my favorite programs. You guys are too young to remember these. But it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. Very unrealistic. I didn't know it was unrealistic, but I love Donna Reed. Oh, my God. She wore these big, big dresses with all these petticoats under it. And she wore 4-inch heels. And that was her vacuuming attire. That's how she vacuumed the house. And so when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed, marrying Mr. Father Knows Best, and unfortunately it didn't turn out that way. And I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. I think I would have had a clue. I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer, because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism. And I blamed the way I turned out on the way I was raised. And after I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine, because she came from the very same background, being illegitimate and everything. My sister was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. So she quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test. She had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt under special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay, bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach, and they're still married. And at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Even sometimes now, I don't get it. You know, same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is my sister's not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility. I can no longer blame all those people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic and I do have a disease. But today I have a solution, and a big part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions, and my present actions. So at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I did have a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism. I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking, but he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18. And I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. Hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet, but I always intuitively knew if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up like that, I swore when I grew up I wasn't going to live like that, and there I was. Now on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink because I've always had the mental obsession part of this disease. And I practiced it in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And this is back when they really gave pharmaceutical-grade amphetamines. Those docs in the box, that's all they dealt with, was these amphetamines. So I went on this diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy from that very first drink. I had the phenomena of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You read about that in the big book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol. When I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts and hives all over my body, and I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. If I had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night, and I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31. And this is not an exaggeration. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program. And this was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. As a result of this spiritual awakening, I sought out a very specific church. And I counseled with this minister and I told him all about my spiritual experience. And I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. And he assured me if I got really active in this church and I read all these inspirational books and did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations, I could be everything that I wanted to be. After I got to this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I am absolute proof of that because I got really active in that church. I even became the secretary of that church. I struggled reading those books because I could barely read. I did all this positive thinking and affirmations. And the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister. It absolutely infuriated his wife. And the rest of the congregation wasn't too excited about it either. Well, they were excited, but it wasn't the right kind of excited. And I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. And I like to share this first story because it's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. When I got to this program, I heard that laughter was healing. And I always thought my story was just much too serious. And when I got here, I hung out at the very back of the room. I have a friend named Teddy, and she calls the back of the room the half-measure section or the denial section. And I didn't hang out back there for either of those reasons. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. And I literally could not say the word anonymity for over 6 months, and that's with lessons. So I'd always hide out in the back of the room. And we have very theatrical, funny speakers in California that would say something, and everybody would just burst into laughter. And at first, I was totally incapable of laughing, and I didn't think any of it was funny. And about 2 years of sobriety, somebody shared something up here at the podium, and I had the biggest belly laugh that I have ever had. But right after having that belly laugh, I thought, well, that might be funny for you, but there's nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. Anyway, so there was a period of time. My daughter got sober when she was 15 years old. And at the age of 18, she lost her sobriety because she was leaving an AA dance. A man came up to her and her girlfriend and kidnapped them, brutally raped my daughter and almost murdered them. And so she was in and out of AA, in and out of AA. And she heard I was giving a talk at the Seal Beach meeting, and she wanted to come hear me. This wasn't my first talk, it was my second talk. My first talk was pretty darn depressing. In fact, I wanted to kill myself after my first talk. And I had a sponsor who really thought I had good sobriety, and she really wanted me speaking. And I just went to bed that night, and I said, God, if you want me to do this in AA, you're going to have to lighten up my story because I can't do this. And so when my daughter came over the night I was going to speak the second time, she brought her girlfriends over. She proceeded to tell her girlfriends my drink-a-log, and for some reason it was a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head. And of course she's talking about the minister. She's telling her friends, I'm dragging her up to church every day. She's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. I'm constantly preaching all this religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door. And there, naked in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. Now, when she first said this, I felt all the appropriate feelings. I felt guilt. I felt embarrassment. I felt shame. I felt compassion. And I looked at my daughter in the most compassionate way. I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. And my daughter just looked at me and she said, no, Mom. I'm trying not to laugh before I say this. I used to cry at this part, so I'm getting well. She said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. And up until that time, I forgot he had an artificial leg. It was a huge leg. I don't know how I forgot it. But trust me, in ways that were important, he was not disabled. I need a fan now. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me the most important step besides step 12 was step 9. Step 9 is the amend step, the step where we make restitution, and I recommend you do the first 8 steps before you get to step 9. I know some people come into this program, they take a look at step 9, it's so scary. They turn around and they leave. Other people come in and start right in on step 9 and make very inappropriate amends. I believe the steps are in order for a reason, and I believe this one in particular should be taken with the advice of a sponsor. But I call step 9 the freedom step. This is the step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past, and it's just not a coincidence that in the big book, the promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. it says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to get halfway through step 9, thank God, because it took me 12 years to finish that list of amends. That happened to me with my very first amends. And that was going back to that church and telling the minister I used to steal from the church funds. And he told me he knew that. So I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. Then I had to tell him I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower, and he told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him. But the neat thing about this experience is he shared with me at that time, he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience. And that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches, and I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort. I know people who do get sober that way, and I think that's where God wants them to do their work. But if you get sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think this is where God wants us to do our work. And there's no better place to find a drunk than in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, for me, though, it was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So I'm kicked out of this church. I'm 27 years old. I'm full on into my drinking. I'm living in an apartment. I'm being evicted from my normal MO. Lights, gas had been turned off for a long time. But I still had a telephone. It was a working priority. I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. And he wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. And he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family. And I didn't have any desire to get to know him. I really loved my stepdad, even though he left when I was 8 years old. But mostly I didn't want to move to the snow. But at that point, I didn't have anywhere to go except for out on the streets. And I think deep down inside, I did have a little hope that if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado, and I lived there for 3 months. And in that 3 month period, this man and his family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that 3 month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. I'm going to tell you how I broke that leg. Obviously, I was drunk. And I didn't have a car, and in the neighborhood where I lived, the liquor stores closed at 12, and I had to make my final liquor run before the stores closed. So it had been snowing, and we had ice storms, and the stairs were very icy. I lived in a second-floor apartment, and I'm trying to walk down the stairs. I'm hanging onto the railing with my right hand, and my daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up, and all of a sudden, I just noticed another second floor apartment because it was directly in front of me, and the door just opened. And out of that door walked a priest. I don't know what he was doing there. Might have been like my minister, I don't know. But he had the collar, the robe. He's definitely a man of God. And I'm angry at God. I'm angry at God because I just seduced his minister and ripped off his church. So now I'm mad at God. And I looked up at that priest. I let go of the railing with my right hand. I flipped up my middle finger, and I said, F you, God. And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. My daughter told me that was the day she started believing in punishing God. And today we know it had nothing to do with God. I fell because I was drunk. So my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote him a letter. And I told him I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule. And basically what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober, but I really did want to make these amends. And with my sponsor's encouragement on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him an appropriate card, and I would tell him I was still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. and I still wanted to make restitution for my behavior. I did this for 6 or 7 years, and I never got a reply back. Finally, the last time I sent off a card, 3 or 4 days later, something came in the mail with his return address on it, and I cannot tell you how excited I was. And I ripped open that envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary on the newspaper. He just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't. But I took it real, real hard. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me that I don't make amends for approval. Big Book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked. Because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he did not get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. So I'm kicked out of a church. Now I'm kicked out of a state. I'm living back in Long Beach, California. Across the street from Franklin Junior High. I'm fast-forwarding a little bit. My daughter's now 14 years old. She goes to Franklin Junior High, which is a gang-related school, and she's running with a very dangerous gang. I'm doing awful, humiliating, embarrassing things to my daughter, but I was not only embarrassing my daughter, I was embarrassing this entire gang. I was living in another apartment that I was being evicted from. Lights, gas, and telephone had all been turned off for a long time. I'm hiding out from the landlord because he's trying to serve me an eviction notice. So I always kept my drapes closed so he wouldn't know I was home. And they were thick drapes. And so with these drapes closed, my apartment's dark day and night. It's dark. My apartment is so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And unless you've seen them, they're hard to describe. But these evil spirits would do things to me like follow me around the house. And then I, in turn, would crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street to the school ground and warn my daughter and her gang friends not to come home. The house is possessed with evil spirits. And this is the kind of stuff I did that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But I'm not a blackout drinker. I get to remember. All the neighbors felt sorry for my daughter. They would feed her. They would sometimes hide her out. Sometimes they'd feed both of us. We were next to the neighbor's house. She was feeding the whole family and invited us. And on her counter, she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. I didn't even know it came in 100-proof. I thought it just came in 80-proof, so I was, like, mesmerized by this bottle of vodka. But I'm always promising my daughter I wouldn't drink. And something happened outside, a car accident or something. My neighbor and my daughter went to check it out, and I lagged behind because I wanted to grab that bottle of vodka and drink some down real fast and not get caught. So I just grabbed the bottle. I started drinking right out of the bottle. I don't know how much I drank or how fast I drank it, but I do know it was enough to stop my respiratory system. At that point, I stopped breathing, and I can remember the sensation. I couldn't breathe, and that's the last thing I remember. I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital. I don't remember being brought back to life. By the time I had any memory, I woke up, and both my hands were strapped down to a hospital bed. A nurse had just slapped me in the face because I was screaming obscenities at her, spitting at her, and trying to bite her. But this experience did get my attention. This time I almost died under the influence of alcohol, and it scared me. I did not want to die out there. So I finally started listening to my daughter. And the real reason why I didn't want to die out there is I didn't want to do to my daughter all the things I had experienced. All the drama, all the chaos, all the police, all the ambulance. So I finally started listening to her because she'd tell me on a daily basis, she would say, "Mom, it's the alcohol. And if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things." She said, "Just smoke pot." So this is my only time trying pot, but I was trying really hard not to drink that day, so I smoked this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight, tight jeans, and I have both hands shoved in my pocket. And I don't know if I tripped over a crack or tripped over my own foot, but I tripped, and I started to go down. Now, I don't know if any of you have been on pot, but for me, it was different. You know, first of all, I had the feeling that I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face, And this is what I remember the most. No matter how hard I tried, I could not get my hands out of my pockets. So you've got a picture of a grown woman laying with her face smashed in cement and her hands are still sticking out of her pockets. And all the gang members were laughing hysterically. They were just absolutely hysterical. I wasn't laughing, but I could hear their laughter. And as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. I knew right then and there, beyond a shadow of a doubt, pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking, and I drank at the same pace for a while longer. But what finally happened for me is I reached a point you read about in the big book on page 151, and it talks about facing those hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I woke up one morning, one more time, on my living room floor, naked, laying in a puddle of fluid. Don't know what the fluid was. I took the first three steps, and I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and my life had never, ever been manageable. And I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just knew he wouldn't because of what I'd done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, as I just got on my knees and I said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And I managed to get to a telephone that was affiliated with the church I had been in. And I asked them to pray for me because in my mind, I thought if God wasn't listening to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, maybe God would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days, and within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that got me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would never have come to AA. It's a good thing I said, I don't care how you do it, because my mom proved to me it didn't work. But I was trying every day not to drink. I was starting to go through delirium tremens. I didn't know what to do with myself. So I went over to my mom's, who's drinking. But she was very sympathetic to my trying to get sober. And there was this man, he was the mayor of Signal Hill, who remembered my mom from when she was in AA. And he happened to be driving by her house, so he decided to stop and try and talk her into going to a meeting. And she didn't want anything to do with it. She wasn't ready to get sober. So he started working on me, and it didn't take very much. I was so desperate, I would have done anything. So I went to this meeting with this gentleman. One reason why I went with him is because he treated me with dignity and he treated me with respect. So I went to this meeting with him. He and another old-timer made me wait in the parking lot. They went and they bought two beers. They came back and they made me drink them. I remember thinking, this AA is not too bad. No, it did exactly what they wanted it to do. They just wanted to stop the delirium tremens so I'd get something out of the meeting. And I got exactly what I needed out of that meeting. And if it had been any other meeting, I don't know if I'd still be here. But there was a girl there that just shared my story. She said that she didn't drink till later on in life. But she practiced her disease of alcoholism way before she ever took that first drink. And she did it in the form of compulsive overeating and amphetamine abuse. And the one thing she shared, and this is the real reason why I stayed, she said her whole life growing up, some kids wanted to be doctors, some kids wanted to be lawyers, and all she ever wanted to do when she grew up was just not to be an alcoholic like her mom. And I just cried, and I cried throughout the rest of the meeting because that's absolutely the first time that I ever felt like I belonged anywhere on this planet. So, anyway, I got a female sponsor. I'm 6 months sober. I'm on my ninth step. She told me I had to get a job. I had to be fully self-supporting to my own contributions. And I don't know how to work. I went out there applying for jobs, and I didn't have a high school diploma, so I couldn't get a job. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and she told me that she thought God's law was higher than man's law. And she thought that God would rather have me lie on my application to get a job than to stay on welfare. And so the first job I applied for, I lied on it, and I said I had a high school diploma. And I figure if you're lying, you might as well lie. So I added 2 years of college. And I got that job. And I was at that job for 10 years. When I left that job, I'd worked myself up to assistant administrator. In the first 8 years of my sobriety, I went back to school because I couldn't pass a GED. They didn't have classes for them. I went back to high school, went to night school. And so I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old, and I graduated with the cap and gown, a real ceremony, and 450 18-year-olds. They were the incorrigible kids kicked out of school, so I just fit right in with them. What I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for a musical theater corporation, and it's equity, and equity means union, which means that they dealt with big, big major stars. I went back to school, and within a period of time, I worked myself up to business manager of this multi-million dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars, and this is the honest to God truth. When I got to this program, I didn't have a clue how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations. I've been invited into some of the homes of some of the most famous people you see even today on stage, screen, and TV. And even today, I can see myself in a picture with a very famous person. And I still get overwhelmed. I still think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step, and I applied these principles in all my affairs. I'm going to close my story with how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today. I mentioned to you that my daughter had 3 years of sobriety. She was 18 years old. At 15, she got a real, what can I say, she got a real kick-ass sponsor. She got a sponsor that threw up against the wall and threatened to kill her if she drank. So she didn't drink. So at 18 years old, she and her girlfriend were leaving an AA dance, and this man came up to him with a gun. And he forced these two girls in the car at gunpoint, and he beat the one girl unconscious and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And I hate the word rape because it sounds like it's just about sex. But it's about terror, and it's about violence. And after he was through, she couldn't have children. So it was really a gruesome thing. It took her over 2 years to remember that she did say a quiet prayer to live. This man had a bottle of alcohol he was in his pocket. He was drinking throughout the whole ordeal, thank goodness, because he became very inebriated. And at the point where he's forcing my daughter into the trunk of the car, my daughter got the courage to somehow make an effort to try to save her own life. And she caught him off guard. She swung around with her elbow, and she got him in the face. He fell down, and the gun slid under the car, and she ran down the street naked, and she got away. He took off with the car with the other girl still in it, but rolled her out in the street. But both girls did live. The road of recovery was really hard, and it was really long. And sometimes it still flares its ugly head. But my daughter and I both felt absolutely betrayed. How could God let something like this happen to us? We're both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could God let something like this happen to us? This is a spiritual program, and we were working it as hard as we could. But the hardest thing for me to deal with was the sentence in the big book. And it's in the fourth edition, it's page 417. In the third edition, it's page 449. And that sentence says, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. Clancy says alcoholism is a disease of perception. I'm still an alcoholic, so I still get my disease of perception, and I perceive that to mean that if nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that had to be an act of God. And I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God, because I knew I didn't want any part of a God that worked like that. And thank God for a man named Bill Honeycutt, one of those that made me drink those two beers. He took me by the hand and he said, Michael, God is good and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. He said, man has free will. That man was acting on his free will and your daughter was just a victim. He said if man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people. And when he told me that, I had a spiritual release, and I knew he was telling me the truth. For me, that worked. But I still had trouble with that sentence in the Big Book. I could hear somebody share about something wonderful, say that sentence, and I would feel rage. And I sponsored a lot of women who've had major tragedies, and one woman whose tragedy was worse than my daughter's made the mistake of saying, well, it says in the Big Book, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. It has to be an act of God. And I went off on her like a crazy woman. She needed comfort. And I started screaming at her that that wasn't written by the first 100 alcoholics. It's not in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. I took the Big Book, I slammed it down, I said, it's not even in the first two editions of this book. And I looked at her, and she had these big crocodile tears coming up down her cheeks. And that's when I was really aware that I had a huge resentment about something in the Big Book. But this resentment's not only hurting me, now it's hurting other people. And because it was hurting other people, I came to a place of really being willing to give it up, and I prayed daily for God to just help me with that sentence. And I had a lot of tiny spiritual experiences, but then I had one huge spiritual experience. I was with my sponsor. She was sharing about that tape out by Clancy. It's called Alcoholism, Disease of Perception. And right in that meeting, when she said the words disease of perception, I had the biggest spiritual encounter that I've ever had. I couldn't hear another word Polly said. I couldn't see anything in the room. Everything was like a white fog. And I had that inner voice loud and clear and not through the ears. And it said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's world. What happens when you're working those 12 steps is part of God's world. The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car 9 years ago, at that time it was 9 years ago, was part of man's world. And that's when I came to a place of being able to separate man's world from God's world, and I was able to come to terms with that sentence in the Big Book. And I know that it's God's world that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So 2 weeks after I had that spiritual experience through those God coincidences, I'm with a group of alcoholics in a restaurant eating, and I'm sitting right next to this man named Dr. Paul, who wrote that sentence in the Big Book. And I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on him and tell him exactly what I thought about that sentence. I used to think everybody in the Big Book was dead. And when I found out he was still alive, I cannot tell you how many times I sat down and started to write him some constructive criticism. Actually, I know it would have been a hate letter. And I'd tear it up and I'd throw it away. So I never did mail it, thank God, because he became a gift in my life. And he used to get a lot of letters about that sentence, and he'd get a lot of phone calls about that sentence, all from people who suffered tragedies. And what he started doing was just giving them my phone number. So, but I'm so happy I paid attention to something I read in Step 10 and 12 and 12. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because if I'd followed through on what I was going to do, I would have missed out on this gift because it became a gift in my life. And I miss him so much because we lost him in 2000. But when I get up here and I talk about him, I still feel his presence. And what he told me about that sentence is he said he did not mean anything like that when he wrote that sentence. He said he was 8 years sober and crazy. And unless you've had 8 years of sobriety, you don't know what he's talking about. But anybody who has 8 years of sobriety or had 8 years of sobriety knows what he's talking about. And he said, my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as to why evil exists in this world. Anyway, I really want to thank you for allowing me to be here. It's been a blessing.